Morning.
Morning.
I'd like to thank everybody for coming. Today's topic is called Shatnez Alert, the inside story from Burberry to Uggs. And, yeah, I don't know who would name their company Uggs. But...
must be Jewish.
Bye. But... I guess the impetus for the share past few weeks, you might call there was an Uggs crisis. What happened? I actually printed it out to show. Uggs are a pretty popular brand of footwear. I think they originally became popular with boots, but they have all types of shoes, slippers, boots, the works. Pretty major footwear company. And it seems over the years there were issues of shoes, which I'll explain soon, that had shatnez, which simply put, we'll get into more specific, is having wool and linen inside that garment, or for this matter, the shoe. And what made the issue blow up was the following email or message. A woman reached out to the company, her name is Chaya, asking if the products of Uggs, obviously if they have wool, that's where you get into issues, you can't have linen. So Uggs responded that yes, all of our products contain linen. Linen is a material which is very strong, and it's good for holding things together. So Uggs sent out a message to everybody that yes, all of our products contain linen. So thus, if you have any wool within that shoe, you would have an issue of shatnez. So this obviously caused hysteria. It's snowing in New York. What are women going to wear if they don't have their Uggs? It's a big problem. Not everyone could get on the plane and come to Florida and throw away their Uggs. And this was going through all the chats everywhere. This email, this message, oh my gosh, Uggs have shatnez. And later, the company itself, I mean, to see how much of, you know, last year we gave a share, remember, on the issues of Quicken Loans and potential issues of the Isser of Ribbis, of paying extra interest. And the Orthodox Jewish world made such an impact that Dan Gilbert, the owner of the Cleveland Cavaliers, also the owner of Quicken Loans, had to actually change the whole setup of his loans to accommodate the Orthodox Jewish world. So this one gets even weirder. A major company representative of Uggs saw they were getting 500 calls a day about this issue. And one of the people flagged on what you call Yeshiva World News.
Here it is.
A quote-unquote, big quotes on that, a Torah website. They responded. I saw the story on Yeshiva World News. Someone wrote an article about it. It's Rabbi Hoffman. And they responded to him. Uggs made a whole response to him. And there, Uggs stepped back from that original statement. They pushed it away. They said that was erroneous information. And none of our current products have any wool and linen together. So they backtracked. Right?
That's from the president of the company, Mr. Cohn.
Yeah. So you really got into issues there. On the one hand, the company first acknowledged that they have linen in all the products. And then the company, a while later, after a firestorm, or the potential loss of business from all these Orthodox Jews who need to buy their Uggs, they step back. No, mistake. We don't have linen. Everything's fine. Meanwhile, you have shot in his labs, as we'll talk about, all over the country, people are bringing in their boots, their shoes to be tested. And even after that declaration that there's nothing in our current products that have shatnez, they found products in the current line that have shatnez. In total of what I came across, it seems like close to a dozen styles, dozen different pairs of shoes, slippers, boots, had shatnez. That's a problem. So we'll see a little bit later in the share how the current, how Rabbanim Poskim dealt with this issue. Firstly, let's give a second introduction. Really, this Isser of Shatnez, I guess one way to put it, to have kosher clothing is an idea, an Isser in the Torah, which needs public awareness. I thought of the comparison. We know there is an Isser of Lashon Hara, an Isser of slandering, speaking badly about another person. And the Chafetz Chaim, the great sage, as the institution traces its roots back to, he was the first. He wrote a sefer about it. He wrote a book about it. And that, together with here in the past 30 years, is a wonderful organization, the Chafetz Chaim Heritage Foundation, which spreads awareness of a person being careful of what they say. But that all being said, no pun intended, the Isser of Lashon Hara is still something which somewhat lags behind. People, yeah, there's something wrong about it, but when something's not in the fiber of Judaism, that people know this is something that's also, okay, kosher food, that we know, we're all brought up that way. Lashon Hara, maybe that's like an extra piety, extra, you know, special thing. Oh, really? What comes out of your mouth is the same thing what goes in your mouth. They're both directed by the Torah. Similarly, the idea of shatnez is something which is probably even worse off and less well known as the Isser of Lashon Hara. There was a Jew who survived World War II, came to America in the early 40s. His name is Rabbi Joseph Rosenberger. This person grew up in a family. His father was involved in the textile business. And he came to the Lower East Side of Manhattan, which at that point was probably the most bustling Jewish community in, for sure, America. And he saw that people had no clue about this history. He grew up in Europe, and they knew about shatnez. And here in America, everybody is, you know, getting suits, getting clothing, working in the garment business. And there are issues involved with shatnez. Really, you know, even a garment worker, if they would make a garment which has shatnez on it over their, let's say, their knee as they're sewing it, that would be potentially an Isser. It's Durabonim we'll talk about. But even that would be an Isser. You're not wearing it, but it's resting on your knee as you make it. That potentially is a problem. So there was very small awareness of it. And this person, Joseph Rosenberger, literally dedicated his life for championing the cause, the Isser of Shatnez, teaching people about it. He himself opened the first shatnez lab in Williamsburg, which I believe still exists today, and did a lot for the knowledge. And he went to school in New York on textiles. He spent a lot of time in the garment industry, and he developed a system how to make tests and how to figure out the composition of the fibers in a garment. So he spread the word. He literally spent his whole life doing it. So much so, you see in the Jewish press and other Jewish Ted periodicals, every year Zeretzeit is Zayin Mar Cheshvan. And there's a little ad that runs every single year asking people if they could learn Mishnayos, if they could do something, say Kaddish for his neshama. He didn't have a chance to learn as much as he would have wanted in life. He was busy with this crusade to teach people about Shatnas. So really, you know, he deserves a lot of credit and a lot of zechusim. Now, what's the Isser of Shatnas? The Torah in two places mentions one should not have Shatnas. One should not be wearing Shatnas. And the Gemara and Yevamos, which is on the top of your page, deals with the fact that any time the Torah writes something twice, there's obviously a purpose in each time the Torah wrote it. And some added laws, some added halachas, are learned from the fact the Torah wrote it. So, one pasuk is, Beged klaim shatnez lo yala alecha, a beged of shatnez you shouldn't put on you. Together with another pasuk, the Torah writes a second time, lo silba shatnez. So, lomali, why do I need both? Shema min alafuni, must be he's coming to teach me something. So the Gemara says, "Hani misrach trichi." I need both psukim. Dikas rachmana lo yal alecha. If the Torah wrote you shouldn't put shatnez upon you, hava mina kol derech ala aser rachmana. I would think any time shatnez is on top of you, is on you, that would be a prohibition. Va'afilu mochrei ksus. And even if you're just a salesman, right? In the olden days, and still in Mexico. Right, somebody wants to sell you, you know, a nice shirt, so they would wear layers of shirts. So, would I be allowed to sell shirts? I have it on me, really, just to sell it. Or another way to do it is you're a model, right? You're working in the stand, you're selling jerseys at a ball game. So, of course, you walk around wearing a jersey, but you're wearing it just to sell it. So that the Gemara is makel. The Gemara says, no, that's okay. If you're just doing it to sell, that's different. Then the Gemara says further, you have a lot of hana. If you just put it on for a moment, not. So here the Gemara defines, the Isser is, if you're wearing a garment, that you're getting benefit from, you're getting hana. And the hana doesn't have to be you're wearing it all day, even if you're wearing it just for one moment, for part of the time, but it in some way is helping clothe you, giving you warmth. So then, that's part of the Isser of Shatnas. And we'll see a little bit later, I want to get into a few practical cases. There are some things, you know, one thing debated, a baseball glove. Do you have to check a baseball glove for shatnez? Is that something which you call you're getting hana from in wearing it? Interesting. Right? Oh, trying on a suit, right, that would be just, that's an interesting thing. Is that like mochrei ksus? Or is that even on putting on something for a minute? I'm not sure, it's a very interesting point. Right, you're definitely wearing it once you try on, even though for a short amount of time. Right? So, okay, I'm not sure. We'll get to in a moment. We'll talk about all the different scenarios of checking things beforehand. Now, shatnez, the word itself, shatnez, is a funny word. Really, the most simple term to call shatnez is klayim, by begadim. There really is an Isser, shatnez is really part of a broader Isser the Torah has. You can't mix things. You can't mix breed. For example, you have a field and you're growing grapes and next to it you're growing cherries. You can't sort of have them like get nutrients and sort of grow together. That's klayim. That's one of the Isser in the Torah. You can't mix the two. So similarly, the Torah has, not just with things currently growing, but that also applies to different fibers. On the person's beged, one cannot have wool and linen mixed together. Now, The word shatnez is really made up of three different words. Shua, tu, tavi, v'nu. I remember I learned this when I was in high school. I still look at it as a high school kid. I heard about this. What shatnez is shui, tu, v'nu? To me, it sounded like Donald Duck's three kids. Huey, Dewey, and Louie. Just being honest. That's what shui, tu, v'nu to me was. But shui means it's supposed to be smooth. Tui means that it's spun. And nose means that it was twined. And actually, this stems from the Gemara, but the Rishonim debate, do all three of those processes involve in the making of components for a garment? Do they all have to be done together? Maybe just one of the three? And the Rishonim debate this. How processed does that the wool and linen have to be in order to be an Isser Daraisa? It's different. We showed him, talk about it. Yes?
Does it matter if the wool and linen, like if they're in the same garment, they don't touch at all?
Yes, I'm about to get to that. As was just brought up, let's say you have a clothing that part of the clothing has, part of that beged has shatnez, but the rest of it doesn't. I'm thinking perhaps as an example, just to emphasize it. Let's say a kala, a bride's gown. So she's going to have a whole train behind her. Let's say the bottom part of that train, which is not on her, it's touching the floor, has shatnez. But that's totally connected to the rest of her gown, which does not have shatnez. That would still be a problem. As long as it's one beged, it's one garment, even if part of it has shatnez in it, even if the part that has shatnez right now is not touching your body, Shulchan Aruch speaks out this case, that would be a problem. So as long as it's a garment that has anywhere within this garment shatnez, you have a problem. And it goes even further. We're talking now, for the most part, the Isser of shatnez midaraisa, which many, many of the cases are. The Rabbanon also took it a step further. So shatnez is when you're wearing a garment that has wool and linen mixed in it. Right, to have it in your drawer, which you never wear, is not a problem. Obviously, it's dangerous because you might come to use it by mistake. But just owning shatnez is not a problem. And we'll talk a little bit later about selling shatnez. But once you're wearing it, that's a problem. But the rabbis went one step further. The rabbis put an additional isser on a person sitting on shatnez. So let's say a chair that you have, a mattress, a rug, has shatnez, that potentially is a problem too. And the rabbis even made it stronger. Let's say you're sitting on like multiple layers of cushion, which really a lot of these things is a fabric that covers it. There's a cushioning underneath. And the rabbi said, we can't distinguish between this and that. If underneath that part, the covered part is shatnez, that's a problem. Now we'll talk. I haven't heard of people schlepping mattresses into the shatnez factory.
How about their car seats?
Yeah.
They could, yeah.
Yeah, that would be this same issue, potentially, of sitting on shatnez. For the most part, just for everyone to relax, I haven't heard of too many stories of these types of things. There is some crazy story about the stipler. That the Stipler Gaon was a big tzaddik from originally from Europe, later in Bnei Brak, father of Chaim Kanievsky. And he used to have these like 36-hour straight learning periods before he would take a nap. And he was on his way to a date. And he had to travel on the train. So he figured he'll catch up on the sleep on the train before the date, so he learned for 36 hours straight, gets on the train before the date. he gets in the train and he sees the composition of the seat. And he was worried that it had shatnez in it. So he stood the whole ride. Or at least wouldn't put his back on it, whatever the situation was. So let's just say he didn't get good sleep going into that date. Not a good idea. I forgot the end of the story. Was it a good shidduch? Not a good shidduch, but... Huh? What was the end of the story?
Right. His wife, and was the cousin Misha's sister-in-law. And after they went out, cousin Ish asked his sister-in-law, how did it go? And she said, I don't know what kind of guy you set me up with, but he kept dozing off in the middle of the day. This guy's strange. That's how the story became known. So the cousin Ish went back to the stipler and said, like, what's going on? She said, so that's, he told him this story. So he said, oh, now I understand.
So I'll just add one thing. He said it beautifully, right, Flamelt, that the date ended up going on and he dozed off and the girl was upset about it, who was the Chazon Ish's sister, great posek from Eretz Yisrael, and he went back to the stipler. Well, what happened? How come he dozed off the whole time? So he told him the story. So in the Chazon Ish's house, that wasn't a chesaron, that wasn't a problem. That was a maila. This young yeshiva student is really careful about Torah, potential Isurim.
Did this happen in Israel?
Huh?
Happened in Israel?
I wonder.
I don't know.
Could be probably in Europe.
It happened in Europe.
Probably in Europe.
This seat issue was a known issue in Europe.
Right. So, you see that there's all different, right? All these different potential problems with shatnez is a big deal. It's an issur d'oraisa. It's something which has major ramifications, even if part of a beged has shatnez. It's something which the Rabbanan added to it, sitting on things that are shatnez potentially is also a problem. And thus, yeah, especially like we started, this is an isser, this is a prohibition, which is not so well known. And to whatever degree it's known, you go through Shulchan Aruch, there are seven simanim in Shulchan Aruch, Yeridea, about shatnez. It's not so simple, some complicated halachas. And yeah, definitely... Thankfully, today's world, in any major Jewish city, there are people, talk to Rabbi Selmar over here, there are people that are, they have shatnez labs, or people that are trained to do testing on clothing to see if it's shatnez or not. And, you know, thankfully, it's come a long way from the early 1940s, but still, the awareness of shatnez still somewhat lags behind. Now, I'd like to deal with an interesting lumdisha question, academic question about shatnez. Right? Simple halacha, right? Your Pesach Kumin is sitting there with his trusty workers. And they're cooking up a nice cholent for a kiddush. One of his workers called in sick, so he had to get his cousin to come in. This guy came in, and starts helping with the cholent. And didn't realize the ham and cheese sandwich he was eating before was still residue on his hands, didn't wash his hands so well. And a little piece falls into the cholent. What happens if a little piece of ham falls into your cholent? You got problems, right? Oh, so luckily, again, this is not a way to flavor cholent. You could, this only works bidyeved, right? If this already happened, okay, you taste it, doesn't even find the taste, everything is fine. But a little drop of chazer falls into your cholent. The halacha is it's batal b'shishim. If there's 60 times the Mount of Kosher to the Mount of Treif, then it's nullified. And Mazel Tov, enjoy the Kiddush. And don't tell anyone about it either. That's what happens. So I don't get it. The halacha is, and it's beferish in the Shulchan Aruch, if you look in the middle of your page, Acher shenasa chutin, once the threads are made, ein leklayim shir. When it comes to shatnez, there's no amount. Afilu chut kol shehu, even one little strand, shel tzemer bebeged gadol shel pishtin, ol shel pishtin b'tzemer, is aser. And the Ramah adds, even if that chut is missing, you'll know where it is. Lo shayich bitul, you can't do this bitul. Why not? Why do we say one strand? Right, that's all you need. You have a woolen baguette and one strand of linen is in there. It's not bottle. Why not? If I could nullify chazer, I could nullify pig, why can't I nullify this little bit of shatnez, this little bit, this strand of linen?
There's precedent on
chametz
on Pesach.
Chametz on Pesach is a different thing. There specifically, that's one halacha about chametz, that feel be'elef lo batel. Right? That's a special din by chametz that we don't have that. But is that the same din over here when it comes to shatnez, one strand of linen? Okay, very good point. We'll get to that in a moment. That's the Shach's idea. Yeah?
It's also continuous as opposed to the food you eat. It's gone. In other words, it's not going away.
Okay, well, the food is there until you eat it. You know, when you put food down in a Jewish establishment, you think it's gone already. But.
So, definition. What is the definition of when it comes to chazer, right, the ham sandwich? So ham is aser. So I have something aser, that's this thing, and I'm going to put it in something more to that thing. What is shatnez? As soon as you run, maybe, as soon as you run a strand of wool through a linen garment, then that piece of garment is now shatnez. You're not being mavatal the wool into the linen, you have to be mavatal the iser. And the
okay.
Torah said that shatnez is...
Excellent, excellent.
Kosher plus kosher.
So, let me start with Rabbi Flamowitz's idea. I'll get back to yours in a moment. There is a nice distinction between the case I just gave of the piece of treif falling into your pot of cholent versus the case of shatnez. In the first case that we talked about, you have a mixture which is all kosher, and one thing that falls in, which that piece itself is also, the Torah says, you're not allowed to eat treif, you're not allowed to eat chazer. If that piece of chazer falls in, so that's a piece of iser coming into a kosher cholent. That's where you have an idea of bittul, of nullification. Over here, I could have a woolen garment. I could have a linen garment. Each one by itself, there's no component of iser. Chazer is aser. Wool's not aser. Linen's not aser. It's only the combination of the two. So thus, maybe the only time we say there's nullification, you could nullify something which is aser, that comes into an environment of something that's mutter. But over here, the two components, wool and linen, each individually are okay. They're permitted. It's only when they come together that there's a problem. So maybe in such a scenario, that's the reason why you can't do bittul.
So turn the ham into milk.
Huh?
So change the ham into milk. And
didn't wash my hands properly.
With two good guys again.
So that's what I was waiting for. You tell me, Rabbi, you don't have bittul when it comes to two kosher components? I'll prove you wrong. Basar b'chalav. Milk? Enjoy. Meat? You could enjoy. It's only when you have the two together that you have a problem. So that should be the same thing. This is amazing. The discussion we're having here on a Sunday is a shach on the side of the Shulchan Aruch. The shach originally comes up with that distinction, the difference between a case of where there's two components, where one component is asur, as opposed to a case where both are permitted. But Josh, you should have been writing the shach years ago.
No.
Right? The shach challenged that. What about basar b'chalav? What about milk and meat together? There you also have two components which are innately permitted. It's only when they're together there's a problem. Yet we know over there, if a drop of milk falls into your cholent, you have the same process. You could have bittul b'shishin. Again, don't try this at home. Don't pour the little milk into the cholent. But that works. So the shach ends up saying, along the lines of what was mentioned over here, that there's a difference between the iser of basar b'chalav, which there part and parcel of the iser is the taste, and something where I could be mevatel, when there's 60 times that amount, we say that the taste is no longer there, unless someone tells us otherwise. But usually 60 times you can know that the taste is no longer there. And if the taste is not there, that's why it's going to be permitted. But as opposed to a case of shatnez, it's nothing to do with taste. The iser of shatnez are the two things mixed together. They're always going to be there. There's no taste. So that's why it's not possible to take out that one strand of linen from the baguette, once it's there, unless you physically take it out, but once it's there, you're in trouble. So that's a very nice distinction why, specifically when it comes to shatnez, any one strand of linen, you have a problem. Yeah. Yes? Interesting point, right? Once there's one strand in there, so that's part of the garment. So you don't need to get the hana from that strand. As long as it's part of a beged, now this whole beged has shatnez. Similar to the idea, you have shatnez on the bottom of the train of the woman's gown. That's shatnez for the rest of the gown. Now the good news is, there's a way to fix shatnez. And this is quite practical. Right? Especially if it's only a little bit of, let's say, linen mixed in, sometimes a shatnez lab, these professionals that are involved in it, are also well, you know, it's not just they could find it, they're also well known in taking it out many times. And they can remove that piece, and as long as they take it out, the shatnez is no longer there, then everything's fine. They take out all the linen. Now they have to know they took out the linen, and it has to be done well. Sometimes, by a shatnez lab, they'll tell you, okay, go to the tailor, and tell the tailor to take out this piece. So, I saw a story from one of these shatnez labs. They sent the guy went to the tailor, took it out, and put back a different piece. Guess what he used to put it back? More shatnez. So, the people taking out the shatnez have to know, don't put back anymore. It can make for more problems. And not every time is it accessible that you can take it out. Part of the problem with these Uggs is some of the spots where the shatnez was, it's impossible to get it out. It was behind the heel, sewn in, here and there. They couldn't get it out.
They don't use any.
Huh? Oh. They found them some. So let me go through a few additional practical halachas about shatnez. Now the first step, anytime a person's in a store looking to buy a new suit, new pair of pants, anything. First rule of thumb, check the label. I don't mean the Calvin Klein label. I mean the content label. Look at the content of what it's made out of. You'd be surprised. There are many nice, God-fearing Jews who just never paid any attention. They bring something to the Shabbos test to be tested, and the guy laughs at them. Maybe I should do it nicer. But look at the label. The label says wool and linen. A woman told me a story. Her favorite denim jacket, she got at Old Navy, wore it for years. One day, she happened to have, it was a hot day, she took it off, and she happened to look at the label. And she said, look, right then and there, it says clear, wool and linen. She like threw it off the lens, oh my gosh. But yeah, you never pay attention. If you don't pay attention to a label, then a label is the first line of defense. Look at a label when you purchase something. See if it says wool and linen. If it does, don't purchase it. Now, I'll tell you one story. This is not the norm, necessarily. But someone bought something, and let's say it wasn't a high-end company. And on the label, it actually did say wool and linen. The Shatnez checkers came and looked at it. It wasn't true. It was synthetic. Now, I don't know, you know, if on a food label, the FDA will go after you, especially in the world of allergies. If there's a content label and it doesn't label it properly, I'm sure the company could get sued and this and that. When it comes to a garment, I'm not sure how much Big Brother, the government, is actually on top.
Clothing manufacturers.
He's what? It's fraud, it's false advertising. They could be sued, I guess. But on some of these things, you buy a scarf from a vendor on the street corners of Manhattan, right? First of all, if you buy a Rolex from there, I'll tell you about that. But, like, you're buying these things, no one's busting them, no one's going after them, whatever, you know? If Macy's was selling some false line of something, they'll go after them. But, you know, these things, Lavdavka, they're really looking into. But for the most part, first step, always check the labels, see if it says anything. You know, this applies to, we'll talk in a moment, many, many different forms. Men's suits is one potential issue. That's jacket and pants, potentially a coat, a warm coat, might have some issues. Tuxedos, scarves, some expensive scarves, have potential issues of shotness.
Do they have to write it? Let's say it's 0.5% women. Does a company legally have to write?
So let's get to that in a second. Nowadays, you do find on labels the following lines. Unknown fibers. This is made using unknown fibers. Obviously, that sounds a little bit dangerous. And really, unknown fibers, there's a new level. You know, I love it when, I guess, the sheer gets popularized. People find out about the topic, and I'm just a magnet. People come to me with stories. So one guy comes running over to me, Rabbi Kira, I have a story for you for your sheer. He says, I bought a pair of pants. And I got it online, sent to me, and I happened to look at the label. And it wasn't just the label. There was like all these, you know, big, you know, tags on it that this wonderful green, it wasn't really green, but green pair of pants is made of recyclable fabric. It's good for an environment. It's green.
It's green. It's right? Green.
It's amazing. Great. So the guy was a little bit skeptical. What does it mean, recyclable fabric? He took it to Rabbi Somar here in the neighborhood to check. And lo and behold, it has shotness. Recyclable fabric probably similar to unknown fibers, sometimes you can have, right? It's an easy way, right? You have the garment industry, so they, a lot of times they cut out, that's what they're doing all the time, they're cutting out fabric to make a suit, to make a shirt. What do they do with the scraps? So they put in a hot dog. No. What they do with the scraps is they sell it. They sell it, and then nowadays, Pumper Care, there's a big market for it. You could advertise it's the cheapest way to get, for sure they use it for stuffing, in, you know, let's say, you know, clothing that needs down or some type of stuffing, mattresses, other things, I don't know. But they could also recycle it, right? It's green, it's another way to sell it, right? It's recyclable. So that potentially could have problems of shopness.
Your mattress could have problems.
Oh, so I don't know. I never heard of people checking mattresses. I never heard. But now I saw on a list from one shopness lab, they recommend many different objects. So these are all classic, obviously, men's clothing, women's clothing, potentially could have these problems. Bath towels. A bath towel is something a person puts on them, and you come out of the shower, you're putting it on for warmth. And same time to dry yourself. But that potentially, again, look at the contents, but if it has wool, if there's any type of linen, sometimes they'll use linen, perhaps a stitch, insignia, or something. Right? Okay. Usually. Oven mitts. Right? A nice pair of oven mitts. You don't know? Potentially that could have shotness. Now, baseball gloves, I talked about before. And depends if you're a Yankee fan or not. That's machlokas. Some say that baseball gloves need to be checked. And now, a baseball glove is not a normal type of clothing that you're wearing for warmth. But some would argue, well, you're using it for padding. You don't want to catch that, you know, 70 mile per hour shot with your bare hands. So you are wearing that glove to shield you. You're getting hana by wearing it, assuming you know how to catch. So that, some say, is an issue. Again, with a lot of these things, it's an important thing to point out. A lot of times, let's say you have something you're not sure of, all that you need to do, most of these shotness laboratories, they're not there to, you know, to make money off, you know, checking your mattress. Just a lot of times, just give them a call, and they'll tell you. Once they check one, let's say, you know, Polo Ralph Lauren suit, this style, they don't need to check every individual one. They know, yeah, they have been using linen in it. It's fine. So a lot of times, I remember you call these labs, you ask, does this need to be checked? Does that need to be checked? Have you found shotness in this? Once they know that shotness has not been found in any of these objects, then you have what you call a chazaka. You have a legal assumption that there is no shotness there. And therefore, everything's fine. You don't even need to check. Okay.
I was going to Austin Burke, and I apologize somewhere. I told her I'd buy two more.
No.
Get them checked. He says, you can get them tailored. They should still be checked. Probably.
So over there, were they all the exact same?
Same brand.
The same brand, but maybe he was afraid. Different cuts. Different colors. So it could be he knew of now I'm going to get to that in a moment. You're buying Austin Burks. Okay. Right? The general rule is the more higher end the suit, the more likely you are for problems. I'll give you an example. One of my brand names I decided to drop was Burberry. Burberry is a nice English clother. There's a major difference between a suit made, probably even in America, depending on how high it goes, but definitely European suits, Italian suits. But in England, they use linen a lot. So the more higher end the suit is, the more likely they are to have linen. So perhaps even there, if you checked one, it was okay, but they're afraid maybe this variation, this style, this color might have it. And that's why it has to be checked. But if you're buying a simple suit and this, and they ask, it says fine, they'll say, yeah, this one, all this whole line is okay. Yes?
Do you have to worry that a linen suit's going to have a small amount of wool?
Perhaps.
Linen usually sounds like the thing they use to hold the wool together, hold the cotton together, hold the wool together.
Right.
It doesn't sound like they usually use wool to hold
But like in these Uggs, for example, right? You know, they use a lot of wool for comforting in different spots, even if the shoe itself wasn't made out of wool. But they have one little spot in the sole, the bottom, or this, to comfort it. They do that. You're right. I'm not sure by a suit you necessarily find that. Especially having a woolen collar. But different clothing, you know, they might put wool there to make it softer.
If it says 100%
polyester, I'm not recommending you buy that as a suit, but yeah, that should be fine for shotness. Yes. Now, let me get into another thing. We're talking about suit companies. So I don't know much about Cy Sims, other than the fact all good yeshiva guys would go to Sims Bash back in the day in New York. They had a good bash. The yeshiva guys were the educated consumer he was talking about. And we go buy our suits from Cy Sims. Now, don't get me wrong. Cy Sims is a wonderful fellow. But there's a very good child about Cy Sims. He's a nice Jewish boy, man, supposed to be having a suit store. He said, Rabbi, what's wrong about having a suit store? What could be wrong with that? If I'm not a doctor or a lawyer, why could I own a suit store? Pretty major one. So here's the problem. Moshe Feinstein was asked the following question. Let's say I sell suits. And it's likely that some of the suits, Cy Sims sold tremendous array of suits, definitely high-end suits, which there's a good likelihood that some of the suits will have shotness. He'll sell them to another Jewish customer. Again, especially dating back years ago. Sims has been closed for over a decade, I think. And awareness of shotness is not so well known, especially amongst, you know, less observant Jews. So I sell a nice suit, you know, a Jewish person. And he's not going to check it for shotness. If Moshe Feinstein was asked to Shiloh, is that the right thing to do? Can I sell a suit to somebody where the odds are he's never going to have a check for shotness, and it could be that it's shotness? Can I do that? So that's a little bit different. You could sell a person meat. What he does with the cheese has nothing to do with you. But here, I'm selling him, this is the Isser. When he's going to put on the suit, which has shotness on it, now he's getting an Isser. Now, okay, you could get the suit somewhere else. So Rav Moshe says, if the odds are, there's a good chance, it doesn't have to be the odds, there's a good chance, it's a good 50-50 suffix, some of your suits have shotness, but Moshe said you shouldn't do that. Because you're setting up a person, it's misayeya, you're helping, assisting a person do an avera. And even if the person doesn't really know of the avera, he's not going to check it, but that's still not a good thing.
Can we say that you could buy it from somewhere else?
So that's for Lifnei Iver. To be over the Torah's prohibition of Lifnei Iver, putting a stumbling block, that has to be that's only coming through you. But there's a lower level. Even if it's not Lifnei Iver, but still Misayeya, so that you look on the back of your sheets, Rav Moshe writes in the Tshuva, he would say in such a scenario, if it's a suffik mamish, whether it's shatnez or not, Rav Moshe says you stay away from it. He says, but if most of your suits you're getting in, you know most of them don't have shatnez. There's a small possibility some do. So in that case, especially it's talking about business and potential financial loss, Rav Moshe permits it. So that's what Moshe's basic gather. If it's a good chance the suits you're selling have shatnez, and I assume he's talking about observant Jews might buy it but just not check, that's a problem. But if it's only a small chance, then Moshe permits it. Right. That's a good question. You know, the iser of, like we said, the iser of shatnez, there's no real iser on the selling of shatnez. Right? As opposed to, just important aside, basar b'chalav, there is an iser on selling basar b'chalav. Right? I'm not going to name the name, but one of the most famous steakhouses in New York, totally treif, happens to be owned by a Jew. If you looked at the name, Peter Blank, right? It doesn't look like a Jewish name, but it's owned by a Jew. So that's not really allowed. You can't sell Bas B'chol. But shatnez meikar din, you could sell. And really, you could sell, you know, you have a convenience store, right? Non-kosher items. But... yeah.
I have no idea.
You can't sell any non-kosher items in a store. Let's say you have shares in 7-Eleven.
That's
another step removed.
Shares in anything. You have shares,
okay, so I'm not sure. You got me in trouble. I'd sell him anything. I'm at home. You know, my employee over there sold it. He decided to purchase it. I don't know. A little trickier. But here, all that I'm selling are Talis says, no, same thing. I'm selling kosher suits and non-kosher suits.
Why don't we just go about
the be the same.
What's in the suits? Most suits are animals.
So,
most suits don't, right? Because I have time on
them. Right, so it depends. It could be most European suits maybe do have.
Why don't we take the whole thing in general?
This rove, that rove. No. So hold on. Hold on one second. I want to cut people off so I finish on time. But in general, let's be getting back to the questions we began. This case of Uggs. So the good news is both David Feinstein and Shlomo Miller both wrote and told people that they believe all the other styles, not the ones that were found to have shatnez, in the interim, people are allowed to continue to have them and wear them until. Unless information then will come out. Because there's been a chazaka, you don't assume just because some styles have it doesn't mean every style has it. And even though the company originally said that, but they did retract it, that's some form of believability. If you look, I don't have time to go through it, but I found Reb Chaim Kanievsky has, on his Sefer Derech Emunah, has a chapter on shatnez. And there's actually an interesting heter for shoes more than other forms of garments. And the reasoning is that there's less hana your foot gets than other parts of your body. Simple mashal, right? In undeveloped countries, you could have people walking around without shoes. Right? Now you can tell me they walk around without clothing over there too. But essential clothing, they still have something. I don't know. But really, that's just because it's hot. If it was cold, they'd be wearing clothing. They just wouldn't be wearing shoes. No. But yeah, there's something to that. It's not the same hana. Yes, yes, excellent, excellent. But I want to end with two stories, tale of two stories. One story, the timing couldn't have been any better. I was a kid. I used to like follow college basketball. So this past week there was a big showdown between Duke and their crosstown rivals, University of North Carolina Tar Heels. And this game, they say tickets for the game were going for over $2,000. because it's quite amazing. The top future prospect for the NBA is a freshman on Duke. His name happens to be Tio. Zion. Z-I-O-N. You can't make this up. Nice African-American boy. Zion Williamson, I think his name is. No. But I like his name, Tio. So Tio is expected to be the number one draft pick in the NBA. And big game, a minute into the game, he goes into the lane, tries to make a move on the defender. And you got to see this to believe it. All of a sudden, his shoe explodes. He's wearing a Nike shoe, and the shoe just gave. Just exploded, just came apart. Literally there, the guy fell to the floor, he got injured by it. And this became a huge controversy. Nike's stock dropped. I mean, you can't get a worse advertisement for your company. Right over there.
And, stock right? Like a rock.
Yeah. Your sneakers come apart in a major game, in the most major player. And what's happening now? People are, first of all, every athlete is checking his Nikes before he puts them on. Right? And there's even talk about this kid. Is he ever going to play another college basketball game? Just go straight, don't get injured, go straight to the NBA, collect $200 million, and then go further. And if there's potential, obviously, hazard to a shoe, right? We got to be careful about that. Well, in the Jewish world, the same week, we also have potential hazards to shoes. We also have to be careful about that. One might be physical danger, but doing an Isser wearing a shoe of Shatnez is of equal, if not greater, and we are all those prospects. You don't want to mess up. But I got to end with an amazing story. Again, as we said, in the early 1940s, there was one Shatnez lab in Williamsburg by this Mr. Joseph Rosenberger. The Bostoner Rebbe came from Europe to America, settled in Boston. I guess that's how he got his name. And he wanted his clothing to be checked for Shatnez, so he had to send it to New York. And he really dreamed. He wanted, like, this is impractical. I want to set up a whole community over here in Boston. What am I to do? And he was discussing this with a few fellow Jews. And someone said, hey, Rabbi, you're sitting at the hub of the greatest minds here in America. Why don't you check out MIT? Maybe someone over there could help you with some form of figuring out a way to test for wool and linen. So the Rebbe, this is a documented story, it goes to figure the head of the textile department in the MIT is someone named Professor Schwartz. For the record, it sounds like his mother may not have been Jewish, but okay, a Professor Schwartz. I'm not sure about that part of the story. I once met the Boston Rebbe and told him I'm from a Schwartz family from Rhode Island, and he knew all about the Schwartzes and stuff. But anyway, he met this professor, he had a whole meeting with him, and the professor told him he got an amazing thing. He says, just a few months ago, we were involved in a major lawsuit. There were workers for one of the major mills in America that were suing their employer for toxic fumes that they picked up through the fabrics that they were working with. And obviously the case was dependent on what fibers were there in the clothing. So MIT developed a machine that was able to test the fibers of the composition of these garments. So the Rebbe says, that's exactly what we need. So, you know, MIT wasn't exactly excited about starting the first shot in his laboratory. They're a little bit busy, right? Every Jewish Hasidic guy is going to bring in his Bekasha for testing, his Shtreimel for testing, right? So the professor told him, you know, we actually have two machines. The Rebbe says, can I buy one off you? And the professor said, well, if you pay me, some exorbitant sum of money. And the Rebbe said, deal. And that's how Boston's first Schottnitz lab opened. Chassidish Rebbe from Europe meets the mind of some Jewish, semi-Jewish college professor in MIT. But that's all Schottnitz is. If you view it, it's so amazing. Here we have halacha, obviously dates back Maimon Har Sinai, but the means of how Hashem put into the world, you could, under a microscope, that's how these things are done. You could tell the difference between different fibers, and utilizing technology to further religion from MIT to the shtetl back in Europe, it's quite amazing. Thank you very much for listening. Have a wonderful, wonderful week.